welcome to another exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News. This is Jorge Facinetti. Today, we are talking with Jill Sisco. Jill is president of acromegaly community, one of the leading, if not the leading, acromegaly patient group in the country, has grown from 580 members to more than 1,600 members. Today, Jill and I are going to talk about her experiences with the group and the disease itself, as well as the challenges, rewards, some of the unmet needs, opportunities for patients, and really what is it like to manage a patient support group. I am delighted to welcome Jill to our podcast. Hello, Jill. Welcome to our podcast. I'm delighted you're here to talk with me about these important issues affecting the pituitary disease community, specifically those in the acromegaly community. I think one of the things that brings us pituitary patients together is the similarity of our diagnosis. What about yours? Tell me briefly how you were diagnosed and your condition.
Well, I was diagnosed in 2005, and I had known that there was something wrong for several years before that. And I had gone to many doctors and had misdiagnosis. It was very getting a acromegaly diagnosis is a very hard thing to do because you have to find the correct doctors that know about this condition to even, you know, have them test for it. And whenever I was diagnosed, I had thought to myself, surely if I had this condition, you know, one of these other doctors that I had would have discovered it. And through my experience, I found that knowledge is key. You truly have to go to knowledgeable doctors in order to get a diagnosis.
That is so similar to mine, because mine was missed for so many years, 20 some years. And it was with the day I walked into the orthopedic surgeon for a hip issue that he recognized my physical characteristics. Mm-hmm. And because he had seen it several times, he knew. The other doctors had no clue. Like you're saying, you know, it takes so many years.
Well, I actually had an internal medicine doctor that I was seeing right after my diagnosis. First, whenever I was diagnosed, the endocrinologist said to me, Jill, have you noticed a change in your appearance? And all of a sudden, being a female with this condition, I just started to cry. It just seems like I'm getting uglier and uglier every day. And she hugged me and she said, sweetie, I don't think this is you. I think this is the condition that I suspect you to have. Wow. And I'm so thankful that I had a knowledgeable doctor that, you know, understood this disease and that was able to, you know, look at me and see it. But right after that, I went back to the internal medicine specialist that I had been seeing. And I said, you know, just so that you know, this is what I have. And so he took me to one of his colleagues, and he said, look at her. Can you tell me what's wrong with her? And his colleague looked at me and he said, she has acromegaly.
Wow.
And he said, wow, I would have never been able to do that. And so to make a long story short, I dropped that doctor and went with his colleague.
Because he knew.
Yes.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many, I know you know this because of so many people that you deal with. The stories are so similar. You first get the bucket of cold water that says, oh, I have this. And then you say, okay, now at least I know what I have. Let's deal with it. So tell me, how did you get involved with the acromegaly community? And tell us a little bit about that.
I don't know if you remember when MySpace was popular.
Yes, I do.
I had, after my diagnosis, I had openly posted on MySpace, you know, I have acromegaly. You know, I'm looking for other people that have acromegaly if you'd like to talk. And you know, all of a sudden, patients were calling me. And whenever Facebook became popular, one of the first things that I did was I looked for a support group on Facebook because of the way that the platform is so different. And I came across acromegaly support on Facebook. And at that time, it was pretty small. Wayne Brown, the former president of acromegaly community, had started it up, and I had become very active in that group. One thing that acromegaly has taught me is no one wakes up in the morning or at a point in time of your life and say, I want to have something that is life changing.
Yeah.
That is negative. And so, you know, whenever I became part of acromegaly community, I would try to, each person that would join, I would introduce myself and I'd say, hey, I want to hear your story. Because with this condition, you know, knowledge is power.
Sure. And
I truly believe a little bit that we of knowledge that we gain from all the patients being in one place, you know, can help everybody overall. And I was, in the beginning, I was just out to find out more information for myself. And so after years of doing this, Wayne Brown was ready to step down as president of acromegaly community. And he asked me if I'd step forward. And I had been to a couple of our conferences and I had seen and had experienced it myself, what a life-changing experience it is to be in a room with, you know, many other people that understand exactly what you're going through that suffer from the same condition. And so I thought, you know, I want this to go on. Yeah. And so I took over.
Well, and you've done a fabulous job. I mean, for all of our listeners that have not been aware of what you're doing, they really should go to the acromegaly community website and check out the Facebook page because it's really fabulous. So,
well, thank you.
Tell me what it's like to manage this patient advocate group like acromegaly community. What do you see as the challenges and the opportunities coming up?
Part of the challenges is that we're dealing with a hormonal condition.
Yes.
You know, and when you have, there's over 1,600 patients in my group. And when you stop to think about that, you know, I want our group to be a positive space for people.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I don't allow talk of politics or religion in our group because I don't want to give patients reasons to fight.
Yeah, sure. And then, yeah, if you want to ruin a good conversation, those are the two topics.
We're all trying to fight this disease together.
Sure.
And I try to make it as supportive as possible. Part of, I would say, you know, one of the biggest things for me is having patients come to me and say, I felt so alone before I found your group.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, we are kind of like a family. And because we are worldwide, we span 6 out of the 7 continents. Literally, someone can get on our boards and at any time of the day and typically get a response.
Yes. Yeah. Well, we noticed that with Pituitary World News, too, you know, which is so nice to see involvement from other places. And it's almost like a 24/7 operation when you do that. Because of your access to so many people, what is your feeling about some of the unmet needs in our community? Things that advocates like you and us could say, okay, these are things that people really need that are not being properly addressed.
Well, you know, I'm actually really happy to say that within the last year to year and a half, I've gotten all the drug companies to increase their patient support. You know, if you would have asked me 2 years ago, I would have said they really need to step up and increase their patient support. But Novartis has the PEAK system now. It has a $25 copay. They'll pay up to $15,000 per patient. The only requirements are that they have commercial insurance and they be a resident of the U.S. There are no income verifications and such. Mm-hmm. Ipsen has Ipsen Cares, which has a $5 copay, and they will cover up to $20,000 per patient per year. And they too, there's no income requirements. They only have to have commercial insurance and be a resident of the U.S. And then last but not least is Pfizer. It has the Pfizer Bridge program, $5 copay, $20,000 per patient, no income verifications. And, you know, you just have to have commercial insurance and be a resident of the U.S.
Yeah.
I highly stress to patients that they need to take advantage of these programs, especially with the uncertainty that we're seeing in our healthcare.
Yeah. Right. Sure. Sure. And I'm sure it's making a lot of people nervous just because of that, of the uncertainty. But it's good to know that for these drugs that are typically so expensive, these companies are stepping up.
Right. And they not only typically help with their own patient support programs, they help fund a program called the PAN organization, Patient Access Network. And that helps people who fall into the donut hole that have Medicare or, they don't have, right, typical commercial insurance. And you do have to have an income verification with that. Mm-hmm. But they will give out $8,000 grants towards the medication. And in some cases, they'll double it up to $16,000. And I know that the PAN organization is funded from pharma donors and private donors.
Okay, interesting. Yeah. So we encourage everybody to look at these companies' websites, depending on their what they're on, what drug they have to take, to make sure that they take advantage of these opportunities for help, for financial help.
Absolutely.
So great. So as you know, we hear from patients constantly through our platforms. I find the information people share sometimes fascinating, and really, most of the time, I should say, fascinating and really poignant at the same time. And I'm always surprised about some of the things that people actually share. What surprises you most about what people share in these groups? Or is there anything that surprises
you? You know, I think that patients realize that if they can't be open and honest, we provide a private space for people. And if they can't talk about their issues there, they can't talk about them anywhere. And sure. So I'm always shocked at how open and honest patients are. And also how much patients want to help. They want to find a cure for this condition. Yeah. Recently I was involved with a study that a company went and interviewed some patients. It was basically about how they're doing. Then they went and they interviewed the doctors that they see, and they asked those doctors the same question. And I don't know if patients just aren't being as open and honest to their doctors, or if their doctors aren't listening, because it was like night and day. There's a definite cutoff, a disconnect between doctors and patients. We need to find a way to bridge that gap to where doctors can have a better understanding. I know that you work a lot with Lewis Blevins, and I have to give three cheers to him. He's an active participant in our boards. And I think that by him doing that, he has a better understanding of what acromegaly patients deal with on a day-to-day.
Yeah, and he spends a lot of time, in our publication, looking and editing and writing, and the knowledge that he gains, I think it's wonderful. It would be difficult to do what we do without doctors like him, I think. Mm-hmm. So how do you encourage people to get involved? You mentioned that so many patients get involved in your community. How do they do that, and what sort of things do you encourage them to do, other than obviously spread the word?
Well, for instance, for our group, we use the Facebook platform because it's the easiest platform, and most people have a Facebook profile. What they do for us is they have to request to enter. We're on the Facebook site, type in acromegaly support, and it will pull us up. You have to request entrance, and then, keep an eye out in your little messages, because we question every person that we allow in. Mm-hmm. We try to make this a private space for patients, and we unfortunately don't just let in anybody. Because as we said, patients talk about sensitive matters. If I were a new patient, I would look for that. And then whenever they come to a point to where they do want to advocate, I belong to groups such as Global Genes, NORD, you know, things that don't just fight for acromegaly, they fight for all rare diseases.
Yeah.
And I highly recommend these groups to people because, you know, I tell people that our numbers may not be mighty, but we do still matter. And whenever you have, there's over 7,000 rare diseases out there.
Yes.
And when you together, we do make a difference.
One of the critical objectives that we set out for Pituitary World News is through awareness and the dissemination of important information, just like you do, reduce the time it takes to diagnose people. So do you have any thoughts on how to reach these goals faster?
So in my opinion, online communities are actually a resource. You know, we get lots of patients that think they see all these different changes that are happening and they think, hey, we may have this condition. And they come to us and they say, what do you think? You know, being a patient with this disease, do you see some of these? What is your opinion? And so what we do is, you know, I find out where they're located and I try to say, you know what, here's a doctor that knows about this. You should go see this doctor.
Yeah.
And you know, hopefully that shortens the time that a patient takes in order to get diagnosis because they're going directly to a doctor that is knowledgeable.
Yeah.
I'll never forget years ago, I was on a plane and it was a Southwest flight where you can sit anywhere.
Yeah.
And a woman sat down next to me and she asked me what I was doing. And at that time I was in a clinical trial. And I told her that I was going to be in a clinical trial for acromegaly. And she looked at me and she said, really? And I said, yes. And she said, well, I was just tested for that.
Oh, wow.
And I said, oh, really? And so we start talking further and she starts talking about Cushing's disease. And I said, she said, well, I was just tested for Cushing's disease too. And I said, oh, I said, well, you know, for acromegaly, did you do the oral glucose tolerance test for growth hormone? And she looked at me and she said, no, I didn't have to drink anything or I didn't, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, so what did they do? She said, well, they gave me a single growth hormone test. And then she looked at me and we were talking about the Cushing's and she said, I asked her, I said, did they do a 24-hour urine collection on you? And she looked at me and she said, no. And I said, ma'am, you need to get a better doctor. And I sent her to someone who was knowledgeable.
Yeah.
It's really sad.
Sure. Awareness leads to interest, and interest leads to questions. Mm-hmm. So if you can set this dynamic in the doctor's office where the doctor has some of this on the radar and the patient is asking the right questions, then I'm convinced that you can reduce the time it takes to diagnose somebody. Because the questions will be asked earlier, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, if you stop, you know, if you can stop, for the bone issues, if you can diagnose somebody early where the damage has not reached maybe what it could reach, the effects, then it's such a difference in quality of life.
No, absolutely. I think that it is a travesty that, you know, people with this condition, it's not diagnosed sooner. I had braces on my teeth whenever I was diagnosed, and it was the second time I had had braces because I noticed a change. The orthodontist had said, whenever I went to him, you know, I was on a 18-month, and I was with him for over 3 years and my jaw was still moving. And whenever I went back to him, he said, that explains it.
Sure.
And
but it wasn't on his radar, no? Initially.
No. But after I was diagnosed, I do have to say that he said, I suspect another one of my patients has this. And he said, I'm going to say something to them about it.
Yeah. And that is very typical because I know my primary care doc diagnosed two people after I was diagnosed in the last 5 years.
Well,
so that's pretty amazing.
And that's good.
I mean, it is.
That I was misdiagnosed with polycystic ovary disease whenever because I was missing my menses. I went to them and they did ultrasounds and they didn't see any cysts or anything, but they said, well, this is what's causing it. And sure enough, it wasn't. It was acromegaly. But after that, I also went back to that gynecologist and I said, you know, I just want you to know that this is what I have. And I never had polycystic ovary condition. And he said, you know what? I'll never see another patient with this disease. I'm not even going to pay any attention to it. It just floored me because, you know, this person is in a spot to where he could help. You know, how many patients does he see that start missing their menses, being in the position that he was in? And to be quite honest, I was quite disappointed.
Well, I can imagine.
With his reaction.
Yeah, I can imagine. But that's why awareness is so critical, because once you become, even medical students, you know, first or second year medical students, and I do a couple of presentations at medical schools, they'll never forget acromegaly. They will have it always on their radar, you know. So it's a wonderful thing to do, because a lot of medical schools, as you know, don't spend a lot of time on endocrinology unless they go for the specialty.
And well, in my local doctor, and I have to give him three cheers, because he's told me before that he always gets excited whenever he has someone interning for him. And I come in, because he won't give them my file, and he has them come in and question me.
Yeah, how well they, that's great.
Yeah. And like I said, I have to give him three cheers for doing that. Yeah. Because, you know, I no longer look like the typical acromegaly patient.
No.
Well controlled, you know, but I still have the condition. So, I mean, it's a learning experience,
yeah,
for them. You know, recently on our boards, we posted, I had posted a before diagnosis.
I know. I saw that. That is wonderful.
It started a whole bunch of patients doing that. And it has just been so fascinating.
Yes.
To see.
Yeah. If you haven't seen that, you should go to the Facebook feed for the acromegaly community and take a look at those photographs. They're actually pretty amazing. And the stories, yeah, that come with those photos.
You know, we're calling it Faces of Hope, because I want to give people hope that you can live with this disease. And because so many people think whenever they get this diagnosis that their life is over. And there have been rough times in my life, but I can tell you that I'm doing better today than what I was doing 5 years ago. And with good medical care, you can still go on to lead a good life.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. And that's a great a message for everybody that's listening. So in that vein, another important issue that I know you and I have been talking about and we've been writing about is the mental and emotional health related issues that come with pituitary disease. In other words, how does the pituitary diseases that we have affect our mental and emotional health? How important do you think this issue is, and what is your perspective?
Well, you know, we have to remember we're dealing with a hormonal condition.
Yeah.
you know, that factored in with the physical changes that we face, you know, the financial burden it causes. Honestly, we see across the board many patients that deal with depression, anxiety, you know. As I've said in the past, it's not an easy condition to deal with, because you're hit on so many different directions.
Mm-hmm.
That you have to. Many patients are, unfortunately, have to medicate for those conditions also.
Yeah. So some of the experts are saying that there's also a diagnostic opportunity with recognizing some of the issues, the mental and emotional issues. And as many doctors and many endocrinologists are looking at pituitary issues when they see those emotional issues. So I know that there's been some cases where people are diagnosed because of the way they're feeling. And the doctor suspects that there may be a pituitary issue.
Well, one of the things that I see quite often with acromegaly patients is a quickness to anger.
Short temper.
Yes, very, very short temper. And honestly, when especially when I'm talking to family members of people, which we also have a family and loved ones group that we don't allow patients in.
Oh, that's wonderful to know.
So that they have a place to vent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the only, it's a totally private group. It's ran by Tanya Angus's family. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with
her. Yes, I'm familiar with her.
And because they really went through the gamut with her before she passed away. Yeah. And but I always tell them, I'm sure it's not easy living with someone with acromegaly, because, you know, even myself, which I consider myself pretty well controlled, mm-hmm. There's times that I'm very quick and I try to not be. Yeah. But I also notice that when my hormones are better, I'm not like that. Mm-hmm. My husband even says, and my daughter, unfortunately, they've said most patients are on monthly injections, that they can see a difference in me right after the injection in my mental state than right before I'm doing injection.
Yeah.
In fact, my husband would say, it's about time for your shot. He would notice that I would get testier. Yeah. You know,
well, I know I was much short-tempered before my diagnosis. And mm-hmm. sometimes you, because I'm a fairly, you know, even person. Mm-hmm. It takes quite a bit to get me riled up. But mm-hmm. I remember sometimes looking back and saying, boy, I can't believe I went off on something. Right. It's so unusual. You know, why am I doing this? And
right.
So absolutely, I think that's critical to understand too. So let's talk about another important issue that we see affects a great number of people in our community. And that is the feedback we get on weight control and bone and joint issues. And it's something that we are seeing that it's not in the literature. There isn't much information. People aren't getting a lot of help. So do you have any thoughts on that and things that we in the awareness business could do, or resources, or any thoughts about?
These are my thoughts on it. There's a reason that they give us the oral glucose tolerance test to test growth hormone. You know, in a normal person, when you drink oral glucose, your growth hormone bottoms out or goes to zero. In someone with acromegaly, it doesn't go. It during the period of testing, typically, it stays above 1.0. And years ago, that kind of hit me. And I thought to myself, okay, if that's the case, if glucose is affecting my condition, I'm going to try to keep my glucose as steady as possible. And so I went on a high protein diet, you know, and I watched what I ate. I tried to not eat processed foods. And then I went and I did more study on it. And I found out about the ghrelin hormone.
Mm-hmm.
Ghrelin is a hormone that's primarily made in the stomach, and it's in the growth hormone realm. And it's my opinion that ghrelin affects acromegaly patients more than what is known. You know, ghrelin was just discovered in the late 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
There hasn't been a lot of study on it. I have gone to, conferences such as ENDO 2017, and I spoke to scientists regarding the ghrelin hormone, and they think that they're, you know, at the tip of the iceberg whenever it comes to that hormone. And I truly believe that because it affects us more than what is known, that hormone also needs to be looked at. I can tell you that I started looking at it myself roughly 3 to 4 years ago. And my personal health has increased immensely.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know we've been we published a couple of articles that on what's been published on ghrelin, and it's fascinating, as you know, as you I think very well said. there's some little, it's just the tip of the iceberg on what it could mean for nutrition and weight control and even a broader obesity issue that we have.
Well, and studies show that post-surgery, acromegaly patients' ghrelin is twice of what is normal. In my opinion, you have to look at all three of the growth hormones and make sure that they're all normal. I can tell you many leading physicians here in the U.S. are taking a closer look at that hormone because of this.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things to really pay attention to what's going on in the scientific community with research on that.
I've seen people adjust their diet and their IGF-1 levels decrease by up to 200 points, which is shocking. In simple layman's terms, it's things like that that make me think that this hormone truly affects us more.
Sure. Well, and there's so many things, Dr. Blevins says there's so many things we don't know. And there's so much work to do in this, in there, to truly understand the chemical mechanisms of our disease, And I think anything that we can do to encourage more research as advocates is good. So, well, Jill, I want to thank you so much for taking the time of doing this. I know we've been planning it for a while, and it's always great to talk to you. And I always learn so much from your experiences and what you have to say. So. So thanks so much for your time.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Anytime.